This is the Age of Discovery podcast. I'm Adrian Smith, and this is episode 4. This episode is an interview I did with Professor Walter Schinkel. Walter is the Robert O. Lawton Distinguished Professor of Biology at Florida State University. He studies ants and mostly focuses on fire ants. In 2006, Harvard University Press put out a book of his titled The Fire Ants. I have a personal connection to Walter in that I got my start in science as an undergrad researcher in his lab. Walter recently retired from Florida State University, and I went to his retirement ceremony, and afterwards sat down and talked to him about his academic career. I hope you enjoyed this interview. So I worked for you for 3 years as an undergrad. And then at the end of my undergrad experience, I decided maybe grad school was the way to go for me. Applied to 2 schools. One I was sort of lukewarm on, one I was really hot on going to. I got rejected from both, it turns out. And rejected because basically for the one school I wanted to go to, my grades were less than what they wanted, and my GRE scores were under their minimum, basically, for grad school. So, and then you found out about it and made a phone call to your colleague at one of those schools, and that's basically how I ended up in grad school, because of that phone call.
Okay.
So I wonder, in your mind, when you go and sort of have people in your lab or recruit grad students, like, what do you think is the most important criteria for a successful graduate career or a successful student that you would potentially work with?
Well, it's actually not that hard to tell. Undergraduates that are highly motivated and interested in what they're doing. And you were obviously in that category. And the reason I made that phone call was because it appeared to me that they'd made an error in judgment. I don't know why. Maybe they were focused too much on your grades or things like that. But, I mean, I knew I recognized your passion for what you were doing and your independence of work. You worked really on projects that you generated yourself and you followed them up, and you had the earmarks of a successful scientist, which is a high level of perseverance and motivation. Of course, you had all the usual attributes you need, like intelligence, and you did reasonably well. I didn't really pay much attention to your grades. That wasn't my business. Something that I've seen throughout my career. A lot of undergraduates pass through my lab, have passed through my lab, and only quite a small proportion of them really seem to have the attributes for a successful career. They may do okay projects, but there's something that isn't adaptive to a scientific career. That doesn't mean it can't change later, but when I see them, that's the way I judge it.
When you recruit grad students and you don't know this person as an undergrad, are there specific things that you look for? Like, if I was going to recruit, if I eventually get a, professorship somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of an individual thing. I think different professors do it differently. I look for, well, we have a winnowing system which is based on interest. So if a student expresses an interest in something that's generally in my field, and that usually means ants or at least insects, then I look more carefully at those applications. I'm not a stickler for high GPAs. It doesn't hurt, but it's not a necessity in my opinion. I look at the letters that they get, and I read them carefully for the hidden text. You know, I look for signs that they really are intensely interested in what they're doing. It's a tricky business, you know. And then in the last 15 years or so, we've invited the top applicants to campus to talk to us, to interview and so on. And what I look for there is something which is just simply human, which is personal compatibility. Mm. I want to work with students that I'm going to end up liking.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just producing a scientist. I also want a human relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And that is usually not too hard to pick up either. But then even when I've accepted them, let's say, well, usually they're accepted before they come for the interview. There have been a few cases where once they always apply, of course, in more than one place, and these students that look best on paper often get more than one acceptance. And there have been a couple of cases where I was glad they took the other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
There was one where, oh my God, I just wiped my brow and, you know, phew, walked away from another one, you know. Usually it's not the case. Usually they're nice people that are likable.
Yeah. You've had success in minting. Several people have gone on to have professorships and careers in mm-hmm. their direct area of study is what that they studied with you.
Yeah.
Just think it says a lot about mentorship mm-hmm. and ability to recruit people.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I want to go back to the beginning and talk about your path into academics. So your father came over here, I think in 1945 as a research chemist, and, the rest of your family came over, I think 46 or so, maybe.
At the end of 46.
Right? Yeah. Yeah.
December.
And you landed in El Paso, Texas.
Well, we didn't land there. We landed in Hoboken, New Jersey.
Okay.
And then we took the train from there to El Paso, actually Fort Bliss, right outside El Paso.
Okay. Do you remember that?
I remember parts of it, yeah.
Yeah.
We were wards of the U.S. Army because my father was working on the V-2 rocket, and that was obviously of great interest to the American Army.
Mm-hmm.
So we lived in Fort Bliss for 4 years while the Army was lobbying Congress to create the international, what's called the Intercontinental Ballistic Missile Program, ICBM. And they finally funded that in 1950, and the project was moved to Huntsville, Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. And that morphed into NASA in 1957, I believe, or 58, something mm-hmm. like that. So that's our beginning in the United States.
Yeah. I think, isn't it when it morphed into NASA, your father sort of left it and then moved? Maybe that was when he moved to Connecticut.
Yes. Yeah. It was actually before it became NASA. It was like a year or so before it became NASA.
Uh-huh.
The ABMA was moving more towards outsourcing some of the research, for example, the Jet Propulsion Lab in LA.
Mm-hmm.
And my father had long been, his conscience was I think in pain because he was working on weapons of war,
mm-hmm.
you know. So he had, I think, wanted to move to another line of work for a while. So he got a job in Connecticut, still working on rocket propellants, but less directly connected to wartime things.
Yeah. Did either in Texas or Alabama or Connecticut, do you have any sort of formative experiences with nature, or I'm sure you encouraged that. I mean, he's a pretty academic guy.
Yeah, actually he did. He was, very encouraging of that because he had actually wanted to be a biologist. But in the 30s when he was in the university, there wasn't much, opportunity for biologists. So he, studied his next favorite subject, which was chemistry,
mm-hmm.
organic chemistry. So he had a strong amateur interest in biology, and he always encouraged me in that regard. But I was always interested in living things. I mean, you can see it from the time I was a 2 years old, we have a picture of me with a bunch of flowers in one hand and a piece of cake in the other. And that's pretty much characterized my life. So he did a number of things which were, which were strongly encouraging. And when I was 13, he bought a microscope, mm-hmm. a compound scope. And that started me on a long series of observations and so on of pond life and small things, things mm-hmm. like that. That mm-hmm. was quite important. We had a family friend who was, he was actually a physicist and he worked in the rocket program too, but he was quite knowledgeable about biology. And so he was very encouraging too. And he bought me some of the first field guides that were ever published. You may not know this, but field guides are a relatively recent phenomenon.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
The first one was the Peterson field guide to the birds.
Mm-hmm.
And so he bought that for me and several other books. A lot of them were actually in German because I don't know why. I guess because that's what my father and he were both familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So there was never any question about my interests when I was young. It was always very strongly toward biology.
Mm-hmm. So, and then you moved to Connecticut and ended up in Wesleyan University.
Right.
As mm-hmm. an undergrad.
Right.
So going straight in, you knew that I'm going in for biology.
Yes. Yeah. I declared a biology major right from the beginning.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was, of course, eye-opening because as an amateur biologist, it's nothing like the real thing in an mm-hmm. academic environment.
So much so that you jump out a window for it.
No, that was chemistry.
Okay. That was to get away from chemistry.
No, it was both. It was to get away from a very, opaque chemistry lecture
mm-hmm.
and to get toward my experiment in biology, which was running at the time. And I wanted to see how it was coming out.
Sure.
Right.
Did you impress your classmates maybe too?
Not so much.
No, who cares? Yeah.
Yeah.
Where does your artistic ability come from? Like when were you drawing as a kid?
Always did. My parents encouraged that too. They would, you know, they provided me with the materials and I was drawing from all kids do, of course. But they seemed to think I had some sort of talent. I mean, you know, it was childlike talent, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But I always liked to draw, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Did you draw throughout college, too?
I doodled. That's right. We had a required art course at Wesleyan.
Mm-hmm.
And that was more than drawing. It was everything from sculpting and making masks and welding and... And I liked all those things. I've always been a very manual person.
Mm-hmm.
I like to build things. I can fix things. I fix lots of stuff. And that includes the production of drawings and sculpture and woodworking. I learned woodworking fairly early. My father did woodworking, mostly of a very crude nature. Mm-hmm. He called it pioneer style.
Okay.
Sort of basic minimum, you know.
Yeah.
And we had other family friends. One of them was a very good woodworker. He was an engineer, but a very good woodworker. So I learned a few things from him. And then in ninth grade, I took wood shop, which was one option. You could take wood shop or home economics, and I took wood shop. And there I learned a few more basic things about working with tools, and I built a walnut coffee table for my parents, which they had until my father moved out of the house, I guess, which was about 1994.
Oh, wow.
So,
mm-hmm.
Like I say, I've always had a very strong, practical side of mm-hmm. producing objects and drawings and art of various types.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever any doubt that you would go for a doctor, go for an advanced degree in biology? Or was that a thought that always was sort of like being able to do biological research in the role of a professor is something I want to do? Mm-hmm. Or when did that thought occur to you?
I don't know when that started, because surely when I started on the path to biology, I knew I wanted to be a biologist, a scientist, but I had no idea what that involved
or
how
you
got there, you know. So I guess that light must have dawned on me gradually as I went through high school, which was a complete waste of time, and then college. I guess by college I must have known. I don't remember any ever consciously deciding, but I did know pretty clearly that I needed to go to graduate school.
Yeah. Why was high school a complete waste of time?
Well, high school in Alabama in the 1950s was, even though I went to the urban high school, not the county one, which would have been a disaster, it was just, it wasn't challenging at all. Mm. And I found it to be rather boring, probably because it wasn't challenging. I had one or two good teachers who were, you know, who really did their job, but the level of performance was really low. I never did homework. If we had homework due, I always did it in class before it was due.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't much homework. I took books home, but I don't remember ever opening them. The only time I ever studied at home was in front of just before a Latin test where you couldn't fake it.
Uh-huh.
And my mother had taken 8 years of Latin in school, so she would drill me before the test, and then I would do okay.
Yeah.
But that was all the studying I did, and I ended up with, when we left in 1957, I had a 97 average.
Wow.
Now, without doing hardly any work,
yeah,
a 97 average tells you what the quality and what the expectations were.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say it was a waste of time, and I would just wait to get back out of school and be able to take my little dog and go over to Pino Creek and look for turtles and fish and insects and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, that's great.
Yeah, we had, on the one side, we lived just at the outside of, just outside of the town in a recently built suburb called Colonial Hills, because there was a ruined columns of an old mansion, a plantation, I guess. And to the west was this creek, Pino Creek, and this is a limestone country, so there's lots of fossils and stuff. And there was a creek on one side which had lots of interesting biology, and on the other side was a low mountain. You'd really call it a hill. It's maybe 300 feet high, which was wooded. So it's eastern broadleaf forest. And those were the two places where I'd spend a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And because it's limestone country, there were a lot of caves. And,
oh, wow.
Some of those were on that little mountain. And I'd go in there and look for stuff.
Yeah. So let's fast forward to grad school. You go to UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
I think, do you get there in 63?
62. Yeah, fall of 62.
And I had trouble finding who your advisors were. Howard Byrne? Of them?
Yes, yeah. He was one, and Clyde Wilson was the other.
Okay.
I actually.
How does that equal beetle research, though? Tenebrionids. Were they doing that?
No.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of an interesting story. It's a, well, I'll start from the beginning. At the era and the staffing at Wesleyan was such that there was a heavy emphasis on cell biology, biochemistry, metabolism, bacteriology. Uh-huh. Those were the things that were hot at the time. And I was, you know, I'm interested in anything I can learn. So I had decided that when I went to graduate school, I wanted to work in that field. And I applied to the department. And I chose Berkeley partly because my brother had gotten his master's there, and I'd visited him while he was there. And I really liked the campus. It was just a really exciting place.
Uh-huh.
And in a beautiful area, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided I would apply to Berkeley. I applied to Berkeley and Cornell and, did I apply to Cornell? No, that was undergraduate. I don't remember where else I applied.
Yeah.
To the biochemistry department. And in those days, you didn't apply particularly to one individual like is habitual now.
Okay.
You applied to the department. And, they didn't admit me. And I had applied simultaneously for an NSF fellowship. And after they turned me down, I got the fellowship, right? So I called them up. I said, hey, I got an NSF fellowship. Would you admit me now? And they said, why, yes, of course. And I said, go jump in a lake.
Oh, that's great. That sounds like my motivation for grad school. Like, yeah, you told me I couldn't make it here.
Yeah.
So, let me show you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I applied to, for admission in bacteriology, which was another area I was quite interested in. And they admitted me, no problem. So when I arrived on campus, I was actually a graduate student in bacteriology. Mm-hmm. But I realized, very quickly that wasn't really the place for me. Neither was biochemistry, because I was missing working with real creatures, with animals and plants. I mean, that was my interest in biology. I was an outdoor critter kind of biologist. So I started looking around for some way to combine my strong background in chemistry with my interest in real creatures, not cell-free extracts or flocculent precipitates or, you know, tiny creatures you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was taking a course, a fabulous course, actually, on bacterial genetics. It was being taught by Clyde Wilson, who had just, he was a young faculty member. He had just spent some postdoc years with Jacob and Manaud in France. And these experiments were, I mean, I don't know if you've ever read them, but they're very clever experiments. They're just really smart things. And I was quite impressed by him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was an excellent teacher, just one of the best teachers I've ever known. So I, made his acquaintance, and I told him what my issue was, my problem. And he said, well, you should go talk to Howard Byrne, because he's a comparative endocrinologist, but he works on creatures, and he's actually interested in expanding the range of his lab subjects. So I talked to him, and, you know, we hit it off. And so it turns out there was this interdepartmental group, it was called comparative biochemistry. And it's not a department. It's sort of a cross department, interdisciplinary thing.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I declared myself a graduate student in. I wasn't in any particular department. I was between departments, and I had Clyde Wilson in biochemistry as one major professor and Howard Byrne as the other. He was in zoology. So that way, neither one of them ever knew what I was doing. Right?
Okay.
But it allowed me to look around for a project that might be suitable. So at about the same time, I heard a seminar by a young, already well-known guy named Edward O. Wilson.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He gave a talk in Wellman Hall, which had one of these old-fashioned, lecture rooms with a balcony and strongly raked seats. So you look down on the lecture.
Uh-huh.
Really nice place. And he gave a lecture on chemical communication in fire ants, including the trail pheromone and the other things. And it was an eye-opener. I mean, I thought, wow, this is a field that will help me combine my interest in chemistry with real creatures. And then the second lectures I heard that were really important was by an insect endocrinologist named Jan van der Wilde, who was there, I think he was there on sabbatical. And he gave a series of three lectures on insect endocrinology, focused largely on aphids. And it was just another real eye-opener, you know, just really cool stuff. Oh, and I need to back up. When I was a senior at Wesleyan, there was a seminar by Thomas Eisner, who worked on insect chemical defenses. And he was a really just flashy stuff.
Yeah.
Really, you know, really cool.
You worked with him after?
Afterwards, yeah. So those three talks kind of led to my choice of subject. Then what to work on, right? So Howard Byrne introduced me to a guy in entomology who introduced me to a young graduate student about my same age as me, actually, named John Doyen.
Mm-hmm.
And John was doing, he was working on Tenebrionid beetles. He was very broadly interested in their systematics and and the natural history. He was actually working on a detailed internal and external anatomy of the mealworm beetle, Tenebrio molitor.
Uh-huh.
He eventually published that as his master's thesis. It's a, you know, it's a work that will stand forever, basically.
Yeah.
So it turned out that we became fast friends very quickly. And I learned about the Tenebrionid beetles. And then the professor that had introduced me to John pointed out in a review paper that the mealworm beetle had been demonstrated in 1931 or so to have a sex pheromone. That is a pheromone that females responded to.
Mm-hmm.
So I chose that as my master's research. And that turned out to be quite successful. And I did that was really the first research I had done beginning in 1963. I had started to do an honors project, a research project at Wesleyan, but I'd been pressured into it and I didn't feel ready.
Yeah.
And in the end, I didn't really complete it. And that professor never forgave me. I think it formed.
Oh, no.
I think that formed his lifelong opinion of me. So, I'm rambling a bit here. I did this research. It was my first research, really, and it was really fun. I really liked it.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up with several new ways of solving small issues and problems and so on. And at the same time, I had gone to, in 1965, I went on an OTS course to Costa Rica.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In tropical entomology. And while there, somebody else showed it to me in a cave, a Tenebrionid beetle that lives on fruit bat guano.
Uh-huh.
And was maybe 5 or 6 times as big as a mealworm beetle and had 2 chemical defenses rather than just 1 like Tenebrio. So I thought, oh, this is cool. I'm going to import these and work on them,
mm-hmm.
which I did. Got the permit and everything and brought them back to Berkeley and reared them. And I couldn't get them to pupate. Obviously, you need to continue the colony, right?
Right.
So I tried various things and finally discovered that they only pupated if you isolated them from each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that started me on a research project of trying to figure out what were the stimuli that was preventing pupation, and eventually decided it had to be mechanical, just larvae walking over larvae. So, but how do you stimulate a larva? How do you mimic that stimulation without actually having a larvae, right?
Right.
So Clyde Wilson and I built this contraption, which was like 16 petri dishes, big plastic petri dishes on a board. And each petri dish could rotate on a central axis. The lid could rotate, right?
Uh-huh.
And then there was a pulley on each one. And we made slices of inner tubes as pulleys from a central shaft. The whole thing was driven by a pump motor. So when the motor was running, the lids of all these dishes would rotate. And then we put rows of bathroom stopper chain, which were either long enough to drag on the bottom of the dish or were cut off short so they wouldn't touch. And then we put one larva in each dish and kept, you know, stimulated them. I don't know, I think 200 times a day or something like that. It would go on and it was on a timer. And we called that the stimulatorium. And it worked like a bomb. You could, and then eventually I tested several other species of tenebrionid larvae and found that the inhibition of pupation by mechanical stimulation was present in most of those species, and maybe in all of them, but expressed to a different degree. Some were much more sensitive and some were much less sensitive. Even tenebrio, which people raise at high densities, turned out to be sensitive to mechanical stimulation.
Mm-hmm.
And even flower beetles, Triboleum. But nobody had ever thought that that might be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And they haven't since either. I don't think anybody ever took any note of that. They still do all those population biology experiments at densities that, you know, clearly there's some inhibition there.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the reason I described that is because that was an early expression of my love of contraptions, of building things.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah. That's you as a grad student, and the way that you came about that project, just out of mm-hmm. curiosity and something going wrong, and you thinking, well, there's got to be a reason for this.
Right.
Carries through your entire career, like right. motivation for doing research and methods for doing research. And mm-hmm. you see a lot of that in that story.
Yeah.
For sure.
And it also, the other aspect that's probably important is the ability to recognize an opportunity.
Yeah.
This was something, like you say, that had gone wrong. I couldn't make them pupate so I could work on the sex pheromone. But it turned out the other thing was a lot more original and a lot more interesting in many ways.
Yeah.
And it actually led to a long series of experiments, which finally culminated in a gigantic natural history experiment in which I looked at the effects of crowding. And because you can inhibit pupation by crowding, you also have control over the age of the adult, how long it lived as a larva before it pupated, because mm-hmm. you can isolate them at different times and create adults that were larvae for a short period of time or medium or very long period of time. So they're already different ages even when they emerge as adults.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at the effect of that plus the age of the mother when she laid the eggs plus the crowding on various life history traits. It was a complicated factorial experiment that required, well, I had a technician at that time and the two of us did this huge experiment with, you know.
Yeah. That was once you were to Florida State.
That was here at Florida State. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we get there, I have to ask you about 1962 to 68 mm-hmm. Berkeley. I mean, that's the epicenter of counterculture.
Like, yes.
At the time of, you know, the peak of it, basically.
Yeah.
And I saw several, in the retirement ceremony, like, I saw shoeless pictures of you.
Mm-hmm.
I saw, I think a knit or a crocheted tie on you in Berkeley, perhaps.
It was a macrame tie.
Okay. So what was your relationship with the counterculture in Berkeley?
I was never really a member of the counterculture. It wasn't even called that at that time.
Uh-huh.
In 1963, I think it was, the university, well, you know, it was the free speech movement. The university tried to boot student advocacy groups. I think they might have been anti-war or anti-poverty groups, something like that. Tried to boot them off campus. They were soliciting at tables on campus where they were handing out information and soliciting and so on. And, well, you know, that history has been told very well, but basically it resulted in the free speech movement. And I took part in that.
Mm-hmm.
I went to rallies. I carried a picket sign a few times. It was the only time I wore a tie.
Okay.
At Berkeley's when I was picketing.
Uh-huh.
And I was certainly strongly sympathetic with the student point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Looking back on it as a piece of history, I can see it somewhat differently.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess that's really what started the whole, I guess you call it counterculture, but it's not quite what it did. It led to the, it was a major break in American society and attitudes. A whole new generation had very different approaches and attitudes toward life and politics and themselves and so on. And I wasn't in sympathy with all of that, but certainly a lot of it did resonate with. That was that era. There was the human be-in in San Francisco, and the hippies, you know, appeared about that time.
Yeah.
The mid-60s. And large rock concerts were young then.
Mm-hmm.
Were the first ones. I went to one. I couldn't stand it. I thought my ears were going
to
bleed.
Well, who'd you go to? What was the show?
I don't remember, but it was unbearably loud.
Uh-huh.
And I still can't stand it. You know, it's just, I don't understand the pleasure of subjecting yourself to sound that's painful.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me.
Yeah. Do you have any encounters with any mid-60s luminaries in the Bay Area?
You mean political luminaries?
Or? Either or cultural.
Well, I went to rallies and meetings, so I heard all the people who are now history.
Mm-hmm.
I heard Mario Savio was he was definitely quite inspiring.
Mm-hmm.
And the other leaders of the free speech movement, I didn't know them personally, but I heard them talk several times. And there was one that I really liked. What was his name? It wasn't in the free speech movement. Actually, it was before. I can't remember the name right now, but he was one of these. He would stand on the corner at the student union and engage people in arguments and discussions. And he was so good. I mean, it was mostly political, but not just cultural and political and all kinds of stuff. And he was a joy to listen to. He would banter with the crowd, and he always had an audience.
Mm-hmm.
I wish I could remember his name now. Eventually, he got jailed on some charge of marijuana or something like that, and he disappeared. They put him in jail, and I guess he was in a long time.
Yeah.
Which I thought was kind of unfair.
Yeah.
But he must have been an embarrassment to the administration too, which was quite conservative by modern standards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. After that, you do a postdoc at Cornell with Tom Eisner, like you mentioned.
And right.
You do a short lectureship in South Africa.
Right.
At Rhodes.
I went to, obviously, I knew Eisner from before.
Yeah, yeah.
And by this time, for my PhD, I had continued working on the sex pheromone of Tenebrio molitor. I was trying to isolate and identify it, which turned out to be very hard, and I did not succeed. I figured out some of its chemical properties, but it must have been a two or a multiple component system.
Yeah.
Which, in which you couldn't separate the compounds or something of that nature. But I'd also done a project on the defensive secretions of tenebrionids, which were actually rather easy to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was already in my
that's
dossier, or whatever you want to call it.
Natural link to Eisner's.
It was a natural link to Eisner's.
Yeah.
Lab, and he accepted me. And I had, by that time, I'd also gotten an NSF postdoctoral fellowship.
Uh-huh.
So I was financially independent.
Uh-huh.
And I contacted Eisner, and he agreed to take me in the lab. And that was a mixed success. I mean, the work was fine. I did a long field trip throughout the West. I collected 110, 115 species of tenebrionids, collected their defensive secretion, analyzed it. It's probably still one of the biggest comparative studies of chemical defense that anybody's done. But it wasn't a happy lab, and I wasn't all that, like I say, it wasn't a happy lab.
Yeah.
And while there, I met a young professor who was on sabbatical from a South African university. And we became great friends. His name is Cliff Moran. He was actually, his field was actually biological control.
Okay.
But he was learning some new things in Eisner's lab. And they left, it must have been a year. So they went back to South Africa. And he wrote me, not email, because of course this was by mail, post. He said they had an opening for a temporary lectureship, because it's a small university, and when somebody goes on sabbatical, they look for a replacement to teach those courses. Would I be interested in? So I said, sure. So we made that arrangement, and I contacted NSF and asked, could I take the NSF fellowship with me? And they said, yeah. So then the last 3/4 of a year, last year, I guess, of my postdoc was then in South Africa. And that was a wonderful time. It was really good.
Right. And from there, you were hired at Florida State as a professor.
No, actually, I was already hired.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
This job ad had come across Eisner's desk from Florida State. They were looking for somebody who was working on chemical communication or something of that nature. And the group that was doing the ad was a psychobiology program, which has morphed into neurobiology. And he said, you know, you ought to go down there. I was only a year into the postdoc, but you ought to go down and interview just for practice. You know? So I went down. I was one of 5 interviewees, and I liked it here. And it seemed like a cool place, and the department seemed nice. And they offered me the job.
There you go.
Which was a little strange, because they were hiring somebody working on chemical communication, but the seminar I gave was the one on the inhibition of pupation in Sophobus. They hired me anyway. See?
So they knew your resume.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what went through their minds, but it's not like nowadays where we have these, I don't know why they hired me, but they obviously thought I was worth hiring. And I said, well, listen, I've got this possibility of going to South Africa for 9 months. Would you be willing to hold a job for me for a year? And they said yes. So I already had a job, and it was really quite liberating. So I went to South Africa. Vicky and I went to South Africa. I was newly married, of course. And when we came back, moved here to Florida State. That was 1970 then.
Right, yeah. And when you came to Florida State, of course, now you're known for doing social insect and fire ant research. But when you started, it was basically carrying forward that sort of beetle chemical ecology,
yes,
life history stuff. And it remained, the beetle part of your research remained a major component until maybe the early 80s or so.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's where the lecture by Ed Wilson comes in, important, because that lecture made me realize that I wanted to work on a social insect because of the complex chemical communication that you see there. It's not like a sex pheromone, which is relatively simple, but you have all these other complex, subtle chemical things going on. So when I arrived, I decided I was going to start working on a social insect, and it was a no-brainer to use fire ants because they were obviously abundant, they were easy to collect, easy to keep in the lab. They had already been shown to have lots of chemical communication. So I did. And the first few years, I operated a kind of a dual-level system where I had my students work on the ant projects.
Okay.
While I continued the beetle project.
Ah, okay.
That and makes sense. I've long been of the persuasion that students have to have their own projects, something they feel ownership of. I didn't do it very consciously early on in my career, but later in my career, I made that very consciously.
Mm-hmm.
The students had to feel an ownership, and if they wanted, they had to be able to take the project with them.
Okay.
When they left, when they went on to their own career. I didn't feel it right to essentially use a student to do my research projects.
Okay? Mm-hmm.
Now, they didn't always continue in that line, and then sometimes I picked it up after they left. And it certainly led me into lots of new areas of research. But initially, that's how I operated. The students worked on ants, and I worked on the beetles.
Uh-huh.
So I guess I started doing my own ant research, fire ant research. Yeah, I think you're right. In the early 80s, maybe.
Yeah.
Something like
that. That's what it seems like. Yeah. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, that, your work is primarily on the imported fire ant, which is obviously very attractive, to funding agencies and things mm-hmm. for control purposes. But your research has always, never taken the approach of we're going to study this from an applied, control sort of aspect. It's always been based on sort of looking at the natural underlying biological and life history questions mm-hmm. about this insect.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
My goal was never to control fire ants. I saw fire ants as a very convenient animal to ask basic questions about how a social insect makes its living.
Yeah.
How it reproduces, how colonies grow, how they function inside the colony, how things are regulated in the colony, and other important natural history and life history questions. There's a small complication here because in the early 70s, the EPA initiated a cancellation hearing of a number of the persistent pesticides, and one of them was Myrix,
mm-hmm.
which was being used as a bait to kill fire ants. And the USDA had proposed to treat the entire southeastern United States three times with Myrix from the air in order to eradicate their term, the fire ant. And the EPA needed a witness, an expert witness on the biology of the ant. But practically everybody who had worked on the biology of the ant had been paid by the USDA or actually worked for the USDA.
Mm.
So the USDA was it's not called a defendant, but respondent or whatever.
Okay.
In these hearings, the USDA was allied with, that's right. They were allied with Allied Chemical, who was the maker of the Myrix bait. So they were on one side. The EPA was on the other. So they couldn't find expert witnesses until they found me.
Mm-hmm.
So they asked me to be expert witness on fire biology. And that was great fun. Because almost all the information was stuff that had been produced by the USDA or by their contractors or grantees. And so I put together basically a very strong critique of the basis for the program based on what was known about the biology. And I wove in what was unknown, what they were assuming, and so on.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be a pretty key part of the Myrix story.
Uh-huh.
And the evidence that it was a key part was that I was in the docket for cross-examination for 2 days. And I really enjoyed it. Intellectual sparring.
Yeah, sure.
And it was even more fun because it was their own data. They never properly analyzed their data, and it turned out they were actually not very bright. And ultimately, when it was sort of winding down, I came to realize that they were actually not particularly good enemies. They just weren't bright enough, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But
so you were left sitting there ready for more, and they were just worn out.
Yeah, or they asked really dumb questions and you know, already had the answer, and they tried to trip me up, and you know, I'm pretty good at arguing, so
yeah.
Anyway, I still have the transcript from the hearings.
Uh-huh.
But where I was going with this was that I deliberately never applied to the USDA for support for fire and research because I wanted to be an independent voice, not somebody that was in a position of a conflict of interest, which almost everybody else was. Because it was still a controversial subject at that time and continued to be until, I don't know, late 80s, early 90s. So I never did apply to the USDA. My funding all came from the NSF, and mm-hmm. it was all on basic biological questions.
Yeah. So sort of a philosophical question is, you just said you use the word important in describing answering basic questions about mm-hmm. the biology of an organism. What do you think is the true power or value of doing basic biological, like answering questions just to answer questions about an organism? Mm-hmm. Like, where is the value in that to you?
Well, when you say value, I presume you mean intellectual value or scientific value?
Not thinking anything of, like...
Nothing practical.
No.
Applied, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the value is its power to uncover interesting phenomena. Because one way you could put it is that nature has a much more fertile imagination than humans do. And nature produces things that you simply can't anticipate. But the way you uncover these things is to work on a species or small group of species and look at the intimate details of their lives, how they do what they do, what the consequences of what they do are, and maybe I guess you can speculate about how they got there, what are the pressures in their environment that lead this to be a particularly successful life habit, for example. And I think if you look at my research output, you'll see the power of that approach because I've discovered things that, you know, that were never predicted by theory.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, theory, I think, produces anemic science because it's too focused on one idea rather than looking for what's there and then building that into a larger edifice of explanation, and mm-hmm. it can lead to theory, of course.
Right.
If you start with some limited idea, you're going to get limited results, and you're going to overlook things that might even be alternate and better explanations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the importance of working on natural history. But on a personal scale, of course, it's just a lot more interesting.
Right.
It's a lot more fun.
A lot more discovery.
Yeah. And what happens is that you come the creature you're working on almost becomes part of your family. You gain an intuitive knowledge, which is itself can be very productive, because you get a feeling of what the creature might do in this circumstance, or how it ought to respond, and so on, which is not just based on experimental outcomes or statistically proven observations. You just kind of, yeah, it's like making a friend, and you know how they think and how they're going to behave and so on.
Yeah.
And in my opinion, there's a lot of power in that. I mean, I experience it all the time, because I know fire ants quite intimately, as intimate as anybody in the world knows them.
Uh-huh.
Partly because I've done a lot of research on them, partly because I've written a very large book that you could kill mice with. And I have the frequent experience that other people who are working on fire ants, or on other ants, because it can be extrapolated to other ants, ask me these questions about, well, I'm going to do this and that, and what do you think? And I said, it's not going to work, I mean, because, and I have the answer to it. I actually have done something related to it. I know why it won't work, or why it will work, and so on. And that's because I have this deep and detailed knowledge of this one species.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's not very fashionable to do that these days.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is kind of sad.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, completely sad.
I mean, there are other people that do work of this kind. You know, Tom Seeley is a good example. Works on honeybees. He knows them like the back of his hand. And he knows all the intimate details of their lives. And it's led to research that was, I mean, it's just great.
Yeah, definitely. So, part of your answer was, doing this unguided, like, discovery for discovery's sake about an organism produces things that are unimaginable. And that's a true revelation and sort of impact of basic biological research. And I feel like for you, people, the media, the public is very attracted to the Nestcast.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you've garnered a lot of public attention for that.
Right.
And I feel like that is a representation of that specific phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think why people are so attracted to that is you pour this thing into the ground and then you dig it up and they see something that they would never imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And the discovery is right in front of their face. Like mm-hmm. you can visualize it immediately. You see this and it's something that you could never possibly imagine, that a hole in the ground that ants come out of is this amazing mm-hmm. sort of structure that they build. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's part of the attraction to, that's an important message, I think, to get out about basic science mm-hmm. is that they do these really unimaginable, like beautiful things mm-hmm. that are out there just under your nose that you wouldn't particularly think of.
Yeah.
And I feel like your Nestcast specifically have had that impact on people, not just the great research that you do about the functionality mm-hmm. of the actual nests. But the visual sort of representation of that as what discovery science is all about, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah, you're right. And that particular project has an appeal and a panache that a lot of other projects don't have. I think largely because it is visual.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, because the objects that are produced are beautiful. And the first response most people have to them is as art.
Yeah.
And of course, that's my first response too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't strongly separate art and science.
Uh huh.
But you're also right that, it's making something visible that was always there, but not particularly visible.
Yeah. There's
some wise man, I don't remember who said it, but said that the process of discovery is not so much finding things that are new, but seeing old things in a new way.
Yeah.
Now, of course, people saw the dirt, the sand, the ants bring up, but they didn't know what was underneath. So that saying might not apply exactly, but But it certainly does apply to a lot of the other things I've done.
That's one definition you could put on art, too.
Yes.
I mean, art is interpreting the human experience for other humans to learn from, and that's,
And I've, well, we talked earlier about the fact that I've always done drawings and other kinds of art throughout my life. So science has always had an artistic component to me, an aesthetic component, aesthetic component. I've done large projects of insect anatomy, for example. And the appeal there is the beauty of the structures that I was studying. It isn't just that it has some scientific outcome. It's that the process of producing the science, the objects I was working on, was pleasurable.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Nest Architecture project is obviously of that nature as well.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Before we wrap this up, I want to talk about, you as an instructor and as a teacher and as a mentor. I had the unique experience. Well, not unique because, there's tons of undergrads that have you as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
But I have had you as a teacher in several classes. I think I took all your classes actually, except for small seminar ones, which I was too scared to take.
They were the easy ones.
Well, no, didn't you have a class that was like called What Do You Know? Or
yeah. There was a senior tutorial. Not tutorial. What do we call them? Yeah, I think they were called tutorials. They were limited to 5 participants.
Yeah. And wasn't that class just giving the students a topic and then come in and you have a scientific discussion about what their knowledge about that topic is and what
it started with what they had learned in class. And then what I did with that was to try to connect up the diverse topics that they had studied throughout biology.
Mm-hmm. But it was just a face-to-face discussion, was the class?
Yeah, but there was preparation too. They had to prepare for it.
Yeah, I was always intimidated by that class. I never took it.
You would have been good.
But one thing that's in your teaching that I haven't seen since or before is in the middle of a class, if things had sort of gone off the rails or the students weren't motivated enough, you would just stop the class, dead halt. And instead of moving it forward, you give one of your, as it was referred to this weekend, Dutch uncle talks, where instead of teaching new material, let's go back and let's question why we're here. Mm-hmm. Let's question why you're here as a student. Let's question why I'm here as an instructor, what my goals are and what your goals are. Mm-hmm. How do they align and how can we move forward as a unit here in this classroom? Which students have various reactions to. I think a lot of them are surprised and taken back by it. But I feel like everybody, if they reflect on that, goes back and it's really indicative of you care about teaching. Mm-hmm. Like obviously you're not here just to put in an hour and go back to work in the lab. Like actually have some passion about this.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start doing that as a professor? Like, how many years did it take up for you to say, okay, I'm going to stop this in its tracks right now. We have to fix this.
I can't put a date on it, but obviously that requires a certain level of confidence in yourself as a teacher.
Yeah.
Which I must have accumulated gradually. If I had to guess, I'd say I probably was beginning to be inspired to do that in the early 80s, maybe, something like that.
Okay.
Not really sure.
Yeah, so you'd been teaching for a while before it came to
probably
that.
Probably at least, I'm guessing maybe 8 or 10 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is where memory isn't so great, but I think it became more and more necessary as time went on, because the nature of students, in my perception, the nature of students changed slowly, and then in recent past more rapidly. And it became necessary to tell students why they were there and why they were paying me to do what I was doing. And you're right. I did it because I was serious about teaching. I did care.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothered me that so many of the students didn't seem to care.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I took it personally,
mm-hmm.
like an insult.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that just means you're engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like the act of teaching. I really do enjoy it. So that when you get poor feedback from students or no feedback or they underperform in some major way, it kind of takes away some of the pleasure.
Yeah, sure. Sure.
I don't know whether it did much good. Probably for a few people it did. Occasionally I would get positive feedback from students that they'd write me a note and saying, thank you for doing that.
Yeah.
But most of them ended up hating me for it, you know.
Yeah. Well, you made them think about something that you don't necessarily have to think about in a college education. Like, why are you doing it? Like, you can just go through the motions and go mm-hmm. through college, but to truly think about the philosophy behind it
yeah.
and the motivations behind it
yeah.
Is something that you're not really forced to do.
That's right.
But you made it a point, if it felt necessary, that let's think about this like seriously and mm-hmm. take the next 50 minutes to talk about it.
Yeah, you're right. Neither the professors nor the students are forced to think about why they're doing what they're doing.
Yeah.
I think it's a failing of the higher education system. And it is possible for a professor to go through the motions
mm-hmm.
for an entire career, just like the students go through the motions for their entire college career.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably quite a few of them do. The reason that's possible is because we essentially are just lecturers. We're not really teachers in a major like biology. And that means that you can stand in front of a class, give a marvelous lecture, and most of my colleagues are good lecturers. There's nothing, no criticism of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then give a series of multiple guess exams, and the students perform at whatever level, and then you grade them on a curve. And nobody ever asks, what did they really learn? What are they taking home with them at the end of this course, or at the end of a college career, or even at the end of the week, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I made the fatal error of assessing that and finding that they're essentially taking away nothing. And that was, for the last 10 years of my career, that was, that exercised me quite heavily.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to convince my colleagues that it was a problem and that we ought to be concerned that our efforts were fundamentally completely wasted,
mm-hmm.
always with a very small number of exceptions, and that perhaps we weren't doing it right. But I never could convince more than two or three of my colleagues.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's kind of sad. But I'm going to guess that that's a universal problem in large universities.
Yeah.
They're all going through the motions of teaching. The students are going through the motions of learning.
Yeah.
And it's just a big waste of taxpayer money.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. That's sad. It's sort of like a downshifting university to a post-high school
That's
mentality.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah.
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 Yeah. Extension of that.
But, you know, surely people are supposed to learn something even in high school, right?
Yeah. Right. Right. A more close to your heart perhaps, you in a teach and role thing is your involvement with the ANT course.
Mm-hmm.
And you're known for the ANT course is a yearly gathering of people interested in pharmacology, mm-hmm. mostly grad students and some professionals. Right. But you seem to make it a point of talking to every student about the project and sort mm-hmm. of doing a one-on-one consultation for right. it. That seems unique. For you, do you feel a responsibility to the field and you sort of want to directly engage with the future of the field and sort of mentor them in this little capacity, but is that a motivation for you? Like the responsibility to the next generation and sort of talking with them about their yeah. thought process and research?
Yeah, you could describe it that way. You could describe me as a missionary, actually.
Okay.
And that would be true for my whole teaching career.
Mm-hmm.
And it's true. It's equally true in ANT course. I'm a missionary for trying to convince my audience that biology is extremely interesting and it's really worth knowing and that you can gain important insights into how the world works and you can form important parts of your worldview through the study of biology. And that's basically what I was always trying to do in my courses. And that's why the courses were usually not just limited to the designated subject. I mean, when I taught insect biology, well, you took all my courses.
Yeah.
You know, we would stray into chemistry or physics or whatever. You know, I was trying to integrate it all into a larger worldview.
Mm-hmm.
And in ANT course, then, I have an audience of people that have already declared they want to be professional biologists.
Yeah.
And I want to help guide them into interesting and meaningful projects or modify what they're doing or at least check what they're doing to make sure that it makes sense.
Yeah.
That it's a meaningful project and so on. Because, I mean, you've been in biology long enough to know there's an awful lot of dross, you know,
mm-hmm.
just kind of going through the motions of science and projects that are boring or just repeating something that's been done 100 times, but maybe with a slight variation and so on. I mean, you've yeah. seen all this.
Yeah.
So I try to find out, I talk to them to see what they are planning to do, how they're planning to answer their questions, and then I try to push them beyond that. I ask them probing questions about, well, how are you going to design this step and what do you think that'll show you? And then maybe I'll say, but what we already know about ant natural history tells you that's not going to work, or this is wrong, or it's the wrong direction. Or this is uninteresting, but this is.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty, well, you know me, I'm a pretty blunt person.
Yeah.
Subtle in some ways, blunt in others. So I try to help them. Most of the students are pretty responsive. They at least engage me in discussion about mm-hmm. these things.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes they're not, sometimes they're hostile, but it's not common.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, it's a community of shared interest.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Well, in your role as a missionary, you've shown me the light, and I thank you for it.
Well, you were one of my convertees,
yeah,
whatever you call
exactly.
it.
Exactly. You know? Thanks for saving yeah. me.
Well, I recognized you very early on as being, you know, as being one of those students that was clearly interested and destined to be a success in this field.
Oh,
I think we contacted when you were taking animal diversity, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I was in your class.
I was looking for somebody to help out in the lab. Right.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Thanks for yeah. taking the time to talk to me. I've learned a lot.
It's fun.
Yeah.
You don't often get to talk about your life in this kind
yeah.
of fashion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Walter.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. You can comment on this and other episodes at our podcast website, aodpod.com. or you can email me directly at adrian@aodpod.com. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.